we go. I will call this Joint House Education and House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today is March 15th, 2023, and it is 6:03 p.m. Today we have present in the room for House Ways and Means Committee members, Speaker Kathy Tilton, Representative Kevin McCabe, Representative Tom McKay, Representative Jamie Allard, Representative Cliff Groh, Representative Andrew Gray, and myself, Chair Carpenter. And I will ask Chair Allard to take roll call for her committee.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Today we have with the Education Committee, I have Representative Story, Representative Hemshu, Representative Prox, and I guess we're doing dual duties with Representative McKay and myself.
Great. Thank you very much. Today we also have Representative Ortiz in the audience with us. Thank you, sir, for joining us. Appreciate it. I'd like to remind both committee members and the audience to please silence your cell phones. And I would also like to recognize Kevin Allen with House Records for his service tonight, and Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Kendra Broussard will be the committee aide. I would like to thank the House Education Committee for joining us tonight as we dive into the important topic of Alaska's education. The Ways and Means Committee is interested in education expenditures as they relate to a long-term fiscal plan. And we also understand it's an importance to our economy to have educational outcomes that are top-notch. Today we have one agenda item. We'll hear a presentation by the Alaska Policy Forum. Members Mr. Bob Griffin and Sarah Montalbano are going to be the presenters, and they will be going over an overview of Alaska's education landscape. And I would invite Mr. Griffin, who's in the room with us, to come to the front desk here. And Ms. Montalbano is going to be visiting with us via Teams, and she is already with us. Good evening, ma'am. Good evening, sir. If you could both put your names on the record so that we have understand who you are, and begin your presentation, I appreciate it.
Yeah, good evening, Chair Carpenter. I'm Bob Griffin, representing the Alaska Policy Forum as a Senior Education Research Fellow.
And I am Sarah Montalbano. I am the Education Policy Analyst at Alaska Policy Forum.
Thank you again for both of you being here. Please proceed.
Okay, thanks so much for the opportunity that I'll be leading off, and we're going to be kind of tag-teaming this presentation. I have the first part and kind of the end part, and Sarah is going to be doing the middle. I don't know if you recognize her name. She had a recent piece in the Wall Street Journal that was pretty interesting. Good chance to look it up when you get a chance, though. Quick overview is that we have a lot of opportunities to emulate success. Looking specifically Alaska versus Florida and Mississippi, we'll make some comparisons, mostly because Florida and Mississippi both adopted legislation similar to the Alaska Reads Act. So we have reasons to be optimistic that we'll be able to maybe turn our results around if we continue to emulate those results. There will be Sarah will dive deep a little bit into Alaska's funding, and normally we don't make recommendations, but we've asked to make some recommendations and improvements to the school funding formula. And then we'll dive a little bit into Alaska's education outcomes, education choices, and fiscal benefits, and a little bit about the charter school allotment program and some of the fiscal benefits of that. I'll lead out with talking about things that we should be optimistic about. That for our National Assessment of Education Progress, or NAEP test results, we had some better results in 2022 than we had in 2019. The results are still not where we want them to be, but that in five of the eight categories that we track at the Policy Forum, and we track results by economic strata. It can be broken down by a variety of different things, including ethnicity, but we track specifically by economic strata because We've made the assumption for a long time ago that the brightness of a child's mind is not really determined by their skin color, so that's why we've made those choices. It is a little disconcerting that in eighth grade reading that we did drop again 51st, and that includes the every state and the District of Columbia for our eighth grade reading. So we have some work to do in the area of literacy. This slide here, and it's odd, it's kind of a busy slide, but it works from right to left. 2003 to 2022 is a longitudinal look at NAEP test scores specifically for low-income fourth-grade reading, which is a demographic that I think we focus on the most just because it has the our upper-middle-income kids struggle a little bit, but it's we're really trying to close those achievement gaps and focus on that area. Longitudinally, you can see Alaska in the red has been tracking near or at the bottom for the several NAEP cycles. Mississippi in the yellow and as you noticed in 2022 was number two in the United States in low-income fourth grade reading, poorest state in the nation. Yet when they enacted legislation similar to the Alaska Reads Act and some school choice legislation, they've been able to climb pretty rapidly. The same with Florida. It's been number one in the country in low-income fourth grade reading for quite some time now.
I think I'd like to pause just a second and allow the record to reflect that Representative Rush Ruffridge has joined us at 6:09 p.m. and glad to see his family join us as well. Thank you for being here. Please continue.
Thanks. And just really quickly, it was a very interesting stat here on this, the red arrow for Oregon, fourth place in fourth grade reading in 2020, low-income fourth grade reading in 2022. In fact, Oregon took a kind of unique step and classified all of their students as qualifying for free or reduced lunch in 2022. So in fact, Florida and Mississippi low-income kids outperformed all kids in Oregon in the 22 NAEP scores. Oops. Beyond just fourth grade reading, we've had some long-term improvements, the significant improvements in eighth grade NAEP test scores since 2003 for both Florida and Mississippi. And a stat that I find fascinating is the fact that AP courses in Florida in 2020, 34% of high school graduates passed at least one AP test or higher in Florida. That's a statistical tie with Connecticut is for the highest rate in the nation. Anchorage, in contrast, which has some of the highest access to AP courses, only 14% of our kids leave high school with an AP score of three or higher.
Can we pause here for just a second? Representative Story has a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair. Through the chair, and thank you, Mr. Griffin, for being with us again tonight. We were together this morning, but I was wondering if the Alaska Policy Forum tracked the investment in early literacy, what Mississippi and Florida are putting into it, because my understanding is they've invested significantly in early learning, four-year-olds. And I would think that that would have a big factor on their growth. So I was just wondering if you've looked at that.
Through the chair, Representative Story, yes, we looked at that quite a bit. And both Florida and Mississippi have had early childhood programs for quite a while. Interesting, and that those programs are fully funded as far as I can tell. And we'll talk about a little bit of the spending comparisons a little bit farther along. An interesting stat on that, though, is that Florida actually added their reading program prior to their pre-K program and was first in the nation in low-income fourth grade reading before their first cohort of pre-K students ever tested in NAEP. So it's hard to tell the impact that the pre-K is having. I think it's a positive effect. I'm happy that we've had that in the Alaska Reads Act, but it wasn't the thing that got them to number one in the country in low-income fourth grade reading anyway.
Representative Himshue, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, for the NAEP, we're looking at fourth grade. So both Mississippi and Florida included a retention section where kids repeat a grade if they're not on level. So do you know what their rates of retention are? Because we won't be doing that to kids in Alaska, so under the Reads Act. So do you know what their... So when we compare our apples to their apples, some of their apples are a year older and have a year more experience when they take the fourth grade NAEP. Do you know what rate of retention they have in those states?
I don't have those figures off the top of, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Himshue. I do not have those figures off the top of my head right now, but I understand they've been quite stable for some time, especially for Florida. They've jumped up a little bit in Mississippi. But the long-term effects, I think, have been overall positive. There's a lot of different schools of thought on that, on the damage to self-esteem to kids who are retained in a grade. But there's also a lot of evidence that it's very damaging to a kid's self-esteem to be have low literacy at later age.
You have a follow-up, yeah. Representative Himshue?
Yeah, one quick follow-up. Thank you, right. Through the chair. And then on the AP courses, Alaska offers 20% of Alaska schools offer AP versus 46% in Florida. So wouldn't it stand to reason that Florida would have a higher completion rate on AP courses?
Through the chair, Representative Himshue, I'm not sure why the great difference. I think probably part of the great differential is there's financial incentives to schools in Florida for AP scores three or higher. And that's one of the elements that we're going to talk about today is that the incentives matter. And when you target the spending to produce better outcomes, then you get better outcomes.
Thank you for being here again.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you for the questions, and I think we will move a few slides, and then I'll pause for some questions if you write them down, and then we can come back to the slides if we need to. But we do have quite a few slides to get through tonight, so we'll make sure that we can do that.
And it's,
please continue.
Yeah, and this slide, we're looking at a quick comparison of where in the 2022 NAEP results in the eight main categories that we track at the Alaska Policy Forum, where Alaska ranks compared to Florida. In the red is in the bottom 10. In the green is in the top 10. Florida does exceptionally well, especially in literacy. They're still continuing to struggle in eighth grade math for non-free or reduced lunch kids because, frankly, in Florida, the focus has not been on those kids. It's been on the free or reduced lunch or the low end. Income kids. Interesting fact that in 2003, that the positions of Alaska and Florida were actually swapped in the NAEP rankings. That Alaska was about 6 points ahead of Florida in non-free or reduced lunch eighth grade math, but we're behind them a little bit by right now. Another interesting elements of the Florida-Mississippi experiments that they have, they've expanded their education choice programs. Florida has some of the most robust education choice programs in the United States, seven programs between the two states, 193,000 kids involved in these programs. The vast majority of them are in Florida, but Mississippi is catching up a little bit. One of the ones that has caught my interest was and that I've been following for some time is the Family Empowerment Scholarship Program, which allows 90% of funding for children to attend with special needs to attend school in private schools. It was previously called the McKay Scholarship Program, but was rolled into the Family Empowerment Program. some of the greatest gains in Mississippi and Florida have been for low-income students, minority students, and students with disabilities, and with students with limited English proficiency. Just a quick anecdotal rundown here, and it's repetitive for some of the education committee members, but here's a picture of the demographics of Miami-Dade Public Schools, 55% free reduced lunch. The one that stands out, though, 59% of kids' English is not the only language spoken in Miami-Dade Public Schools, and yet because of the incentives that they provide, out of about 52,000 juniors and seniors in 2021, they were able to generate the 32,000 AP tests with three or higher. This doesn't indicate that 32 out of 51,000, because several of these are individuals that had passed more than one in the AP test, but it tracks pretty close to their 34% rate statewide. And also interesting was that the fourth grade NAEP reading scores are 6 points higher for Miami-Dade Public Schools than they were for upper middle income fourth graders in Alaska, kids who do not qualify for free or reduced lunch.
We pause here for just a second before we get into these slides. Representative Allard,
you have a question. Thank you. You had a few slides back, but I don't think it's really relevant on the slide portion of it. And through the chair, I appreciate the opportunity to actually ask questions, because when you chair a committee, you can't always ask the questions that I was looking. You always consistently are bringing up comparisons to Mississippi and Florida. And I want to know the specific reasons why you chose those two states over any other state.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, it's specifically because they're number one and number two in low-income fourth-grade reading, which is the fundamentals, the early childhood literacy, especially for low-income kids, is the fundamentals that you need in order to close the achievement gaps between different groups. And so because of those programs and because of their success, I think they're important programs to emulate.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative McCabe.
Through the chair, so I doubt we're here to poke holes into Florida or Mississippi's program. Point of fact is that our students are in the bottom 5% of all of this, and you pick Florida and other states because they have come up for whatever reason. I don't really care. You could have picked anybody in the top 30 and compared us to them, and we would still be failing, even though we have thrown 32% at our students' funding in the last 18 years. So I appreciate that you're doing Florida and Mississippi, but I suspect that it's not our intent tonight to poke holes in your Florida and your comparison. So I appreciate the information. Thank you.
Representative McKay.
Sorry. Through the chair, Mr. Griffin, you said a few minutes ago that Mississippi and Florida had implemented programs very similar to the READS Act. So I thought that was another reason why you picked those two states.
It is that we tracked.
If I understood you correctly.
That's correct. Also, they have strong choice programs. There's a variety of different things going on between both of those states. Through the chair, Representative McKay.
Representative Himshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, the slide that we were just on about, that one. Thank you. You don't have any citations on here, so it's kind of hard to know the context. When you're drawing is it a correlation or causation effect for 32,602 AP tests passed with a three or higher?
Through the chair, Representative Hemphill, I don't believe I'm drawing either a correlation or a causation. I'm just, I find it, I guess it's an interesting correlation, maybe, but I wouldn't assign causation in any case, because it's a much more complicated matter than that.
Quick follow-up.
Representative Hemphill.
So just to confirm, is there a study saying that because of these things, this thing happened? This is not from a study. This is just data.
This is just data. There's not a study that finds a, that I'm aware of that finds a causal link between the things that we're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Back in this slide, it just quickly shows in a bar chart Florida and gold, Florida and Mississippi and gold, and Alaska and green and low income fourth grade reading in 2022. And on the right hand side is upper middle income, or kids who that do not qualify for free or reduced lunch. Florida, Mississippi in the gold bars, Alaska is in the red bar, and I've inserted in the yellow bar is where the Miami-Dade Public Schools kids would fall when they're superimposed over that upper and middle income bracket. The expectation with that high rate of free or reduced lunch that the kids would more likely show up on the left-hand bar or the left-hand bar chart. This is, showing the data 2021 spending, K-12 spending per student average daily attendance from the National Education Association on the first bar chart. And the second bar chart is the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis differences in regional price parities between states. The red arrow shows Alaska at 104% of the national average, Florida is at 101.4%, and Mississippi is one of the lowest at 86.6%. And the chart on the right side is the chart on the left corrected for the regional price parities published by the United States government, shows Alaska is significantly, or at least in the top third there, where with Florida and Mississippi, despite all of their expenditures on reading programs and pre-K, are near the bottom.
Representative McCabe, and then Representative Story.
So can you go back one chart, Mr. Griffin? Captain Griffin? So in the middle chart there, I see this has a source in it, NEA Rankings and Estimates, U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Right.
And probably no study done, but I'm pretty sure I could look at this and see that Mississippi spends the least amount per student, mm-hmm. and yet we have said that they're one of the highest in reading. And we see that Alaska spends significantly higher, 104%, I can't quite read it because it's so small, of the average, and yet we are in the lowest quadrant of reading. I don't really need a study to tell me that that looks weird to me, right?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, just to be clear, the middle chart is the adjustment for price parity based upon a chart that's published by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and that Alaska is more expensive than the national average by about 4.5%. And is the eighth highest cost of living in the United States based upon that bar chart. And the cost of livings in Florida and Mississippi are, Florida's a little bit less, Mississippi is the lowest in the country. And using those factors in the middle chart, we derived the results on the adjusted for price parity of the spending per student and average daily attendance on the right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Representative Story, then Representative Allard, then Representative Inchu.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, in the middle column, the regional price parities for states, did they adjust for the geographic cost factors in Alaska the way the ICER study did, which shows that we're 7% under the national average?
Through the chair, Representative Story, that chart does not adjust for that, but it also does not adjust for the take into account the fairly low personal tax burden for residents in Alaska.
Hmm. Representative Allard?
Yeah, thank you. And through the chair, so I'm looking at this, and you're saying that the average cost per student is $20,484. That's in the first chart.
Through the chair, Representative Albert, I'm not saying that this is published by the National Education Association, which has a pretty large staff of statisticians that have a vested interest in making apples-to-apples comparisons for their members. They have no vested interest in making any state look better or worse.
May I do a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Allen.
Let me rephrase that. The 20,000, I can't read it. I'm old.
Yeah, $20,484 for 2021 is, and again, based upon a student average daily attendance, it's a higher number than you see other places, and it's a figure that the National Education Association tracks compared to enrollment. I think it's an important figure because it tracks, it accounts for chronic absenteeism and other things that actually drive the number of kids that we're educating. The cost is driven higher when we have high chronic absenteeism.
Thank you. And through the chair, may I?
Representative Allen.
Okay. So what I'm trying to get at is that the 20,000, as you just described it, though, persons would say that we don't fund that high, but we actually do spend that much, is what I'm getting at. The BSA is not the only funds that the school districts are getting. And there's another calculation to get us up to that 20,000. Is that the buildings and the...
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I think the NEA does a pretty good job of tracking total costs and doing a good job of providing an apples-to-apples comparison. They do have a vested interest in a large research team that produces this document. It's called Rankings and Estimates every year.
Thank you.
Representative Hemshute. Okay. We'll come back to you.
I have one.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, can we go back one slide?
Yes.
I just noticed I'm doing this analysis on the fly as we sit here. But I think Delaware is did just slightly better than us for low income, and Delaware did a little worse than us for upper income. And I also just did some quick Googling. I see that Delaware did a methodology of reading reform, science of reading, I think they called it. And they also did some additional forms in 2019 to do more early childhood education. And I'll just point out that it looks like, although there, if you go to the next slide and we compare how much Delaware is spending, they are spending less than us, but not that much less than us. They're a few slots down from us everywhere. It looks like Alaska at 20,484, Delaware at 18,500. I just might make the argument that Delaware is not as far apart, doesn't have quite as much rural population, doesn't have a lot of factors that might drive up our costs. So it's just an observation that Delaware might be a good one to also look at, maybe.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I'll look into the Delaware comparison. Thank you for that.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. And I was stuck back one slide as well, through the chair. On this one, again, the upper middle income, the claim of upper middle income, when districts are potentially understaffed and unable to chase down the families who don't fill out the paperwork for free and reduced lunch, the school doesn't stop feeding the kids because the kids are hungry, but they don't necessarily have the paperwork from the family to show that they're free and reduced. And so the claim of upper middle income, where do you get that data that it's upper middle income?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I make the assumption that all states are equally motivated to make sure kids who qualify for free or reduced lunch track them down, and that may not be a valid assumption, but I don't think the difference is probably dramatically different from state to state.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the questions. Please continue.
As far as K-12 spending increases over this 18-year period, and again, this is from NEA rankings and estimates based upon average daily attendance over this 18-year period, that Alaska comes in right near the national average. And I'll say that with full disclosure that with the recently fairly flat funding, that Alaska a few years ago was more farther on the left-hand side of this bar chart. But compared to, again, Florida and Mississippi, with the increases they've had, it wasn't driven by dramatic increases on per-student spending. And showing that this slide shows that our free or reduced lunch rate, we're in the bottom half. Florida and Mississippi were in the top half of free or reduced lunch rate. This one points out that a lot of our poor performance has been blamed on rural Alaska, and well, there is a kernel of truth in that. Some of our rural schools achieve quite exceptionally. That, as a matter of fact, the top five schools in red there ranked 15th, 16th, 21st, or 20th, 21st, and 23rd in English language arts proficiency, and the latest AK Star results that there was we'd had some questions that came up earlier a couple of weeks ago about the correlation to poverty rates and potentially per capita income, and there is certainly a correlation between lower poverty rate places generally perform better, but as you can see, there's some outliers there with Nenana and Juneau having a fairly low poverty rate and high personal income, Cordova as well. The five big districts are just a little bit above the state average in the state. That's basically worse than the nation in this category. One of the assumptions that I always make, and I mentioned before too, that the brightness of a child's mind is certainly not linked to their skin color, but we have heard a lot of talk about diversity in Alaska. And from the U.S. Census Bureau, this shows the overall population, where Alaska ranks 15th in the United States and the percentage of people in color. It's often been said, though, that our kids are much more diverse than the overall population. That is absolutely true. In the next slide, we show that Alaska is, in fact, majority-minority student population. But that same effect has been taking place pretty much across the country. And it's a kind of an effect of as future generations come on, there's fewer and fewer people that identify as single race. That the largest growing ethnicity in the United States is two or more races.
And pause here for just a second. Representative Ruffridge, do you have a question?
Thank you. I borrow. Thank you. Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Carpenter. On the slide about K-12 spending increases, I was just wondering what the selection for the dates was there, 2004 to 2022. It seems like an odd date range. And I know that our current foundation formula was created just a few years behind that. So I was just wondering what the impetus was for that date selection.
Right, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, that's an excellent question. It's the baseline that we've used year over year, that we've come back here time and again, and we've used 2004 as the baseline because 2000, to cross-reference those to NAEP test scores, because 2003 was the first year that Alaska fully participated in the National Assessment of Education Progress.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, you had said that we had a high absenteeism. My question would be, have you looked into the length of school year we have? Don't we have one of the shortest in the country? And then I have a quick follow-up depending on the answer.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, that's correct. From the last information I've seen, and I haven't looked at it recently, is that we have one of the shorter in total hours of instruction school years in the United States.
Follow-up? Through the chair, yeah. Follow up through the chair. Is it possible if we were to add maybe 10 additional days, whether on the front, the back, five on the front, five on the back, that it would actually extend the days of education from kindergarten up to senior in high school almost a year and a half? That could, do you think, improve the education of our children?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I haven't done that arithmetic experiment, but generally, and I haven't looked into the correlations of additional or more seat time to producing better outcomes, but just logically, it seems like if kids are in school longer, that they would probably have more opportunity to achieve.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair. When I'm looking on slide 14, just talking about performance, one thought I had when I look at like the Juneau school districts, I know that it says the poverty rate is 7.2%. But I know we have a school with 66% poverty rate and a school with 50% poverty rate, and we have a couple of other Title I schools. Have you looked at, in some of the larger areas, looked at student growth in just individual schools that have a higher poverty rate?
Through the chair, Representative Story, hopefully we're not conflating poverty rates and free or reduced lunch rates, because they're quite different figures. That were you referring to free or reduced lunch rates in schools in Juneau? Because
Well, that's how we figure out what our poverty rate. That's how we calculate it, as free and reduced lunch is the significant factor for what poverty rate is. That's how we designate it or know.
Yeah, through the chair, that the free reduced lunch rate depends upon 185% of the poverty level, corrected for another 25% in Alaska. In Anchorage, particularly, I know the free reduced lunch rate overall in Anchorage is right around 50%, but the poverty rate for Anchorage is 9.1%.
Thank you. So I guess to sum this up, the poverty rate numbers that are here are not free and reduced rate lunch poverty rates.
Poverty rate numbers here are census. Our community census poverty rates. I have a chart, but not available here today, that shows the free or reduced lunch rates for schools across the state as well.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffin, I'm looking at the I can't see numbers, but it's the graphic that's entitled K through 12 spending increase 2004 to 2022. That one.
Yeah.
And my question is, it shows a spending increase. Is that spending increase measured in nominal dollars or in real / inflation adjusted dollars?
And through the chair, Representative Groh, that is in nominal dollars, but it's the relative ranking. If they were adjusted for inflation, wouldn't change the rankings.
Thanks.
Please continue.
There's been a lot of discussion specifically of Anchorage and our diversity and poverty in Anchorage. Anchorage is ranked as the 71st, of course, in the census data, 71st largest city in the United States, 147th in overall diversity, 182nd in language diversity by the 2022 Wallet Hub survey. There's actually a newer one that came out recently that changes that data a little bit. Of the 100 largest cities in the United States, Anchorage has the ninth lowest poverty rate of that group, and Miami has the 16th highest poverty rate. A lot of discussion has crept up about a study that was published in 2014, finding that Anchorage had the most diverse school districts
in the United States. It was based upon an entropy index technique of measuring the evenness of the diversity. On the left-hand side is a chart from page 377 of that study of the Anchorage mosaic. And it uses logarithmic scores to assign the groups. Because the bottom chart has a very, very small native population across the United States, and we have a relatively even distribution for native populations in Anchorage, that the pie chart on the top scores quite a bit higher on that scale, despite the fact that the percentage of ethnic minorities to non-ethnic minorities is within about 1% of the national average in that particular pie chart. From here, I'll hand it off to my colleague, and she'll talk about some of the spending figures.
So before you begin, Ms. Montalbano, I think we have a couple questions. Representative Ballard.
Thank you, and through the chair. So, Mr. Griffin, let's go back to, it's right here in front of us, the diversity chart about diversity and poverty. Are you, the next chart's fine. Are you saying that the information that we've been fed over the years in regards to diversity and the most diverse state is just not accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Allen, it's a matter of perspective and the technique for defining what poverty is. In this particular study, the author, through his technique, establishes that out of 131,000 schools across the United States, that 27 of the 30 most diverse schools were in his hometown.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Griffin.
And let's see, Representative Rufford, you also had a...
Yeah. And thank you through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Griffin, for being here again. So this is the second time today that I've heard this presentation. And now hearing it again the second time, because we heard it before in Education Committee, I guess I'm curious as to what the... what's the take-home message here? I'm not sure that... Maybe there wasn't supposed to be one, but it seems like there was a lot of charts and graphs, a lot of numbers that maybe I'm not seeing the correlation between those things, and I'm hoping you can help me with that. Is there a take-home message from this slide deck that you would like a paragraph of leave with this?
Through the chair, Representative Rufford, I would just so that. I would point out the contrast between the outcomes and the relative challenges between the two jurisdictions that I've compared. Specifically when we get down to the racial component, it's not something that we look at. It's just that it's been brought up so many times, and that we make that comparison as well. I've always assumed the brightness of a child's mind is not driven, are not closely linked to their skin color. I'm not sure why that topic is relevant, but it comes up a lot, and so we've addressed it in that particular case.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'll rephrase. So, just from the slide deck in general, which I think we went through, a handful of slides here. We're on slide 20 almost. So I understand the thing about race and ethnicity, but just your slide deck in general, what's the take-home message? What is it that this slide deck was sort of put together to, what message are you sharing in a paragraph?
Through the chair, Representative Rufford, the message basically is that as the title said in the bullet points when we started, that these we have examples that were probably worthy of emulating, that's why we made those direct comparisons between the outcomes in Florida and Mississippi and the relative challenges in terms of K-12 expenditures, relative poverty, and those things that, and as a general rule, our challenges are a little bit less than those places, and our results are not where we want them to be.
I'm sorry, can I follow up again? Thank you. I won't give the microphone back next time. Through the chair, that statement that our challenges are a little bit less than theirs. Can you flesh that out for me? Because I've lived in Florida for a year. I was attending college, so my challenges were unique, I guess. But I'm curious as to how the challenges of an Alaskan student are less than a challenge for a Florida student.
Through the chair, Representative Ruppage, I'll fully acknowledge that Alaska has unique challenges, but in these specific categories that we've outlined, the challenges are equal or similar or equal or quite a bit less in for Alaska than they are in Florida and Mississippi in the topics that we've addressed here.
Last follow-up, if I may. Thank you. Through the chair, so the areas in which Alaskan students have a less challenge are Alaskan students are, and please correct me if I'm wrong, so I'm just going to make a statement, less poor, less diverse, and less less rural.
I can go through quickly. There's slightly less diverse. They're slightly less poor. We've matched or equaled K-12 spending adjusted for price parity.
Okay. Sorry. Could you repeat that? I'll be done. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. In the categories of per student spending the challenges of poverty that are free or reduced lunch that are closely linked to student outcomes and our diversity challenges, which again I don't consider our diversity a challenge. It's something that I certainly celebrate. But it's a topic that comes up that seems to be that we use for a rationalization for the dismal outcomes.
Representative Ballard and then Representative Gray.
Thank you. And through the chair, I'm taking away that your comparison with Florida and Mississippi is relevant based on the fact of what they've implemented and what we haven't, and that there's no excuse. I hear the word, I think you're trying to say we don't really have an excuse, that we should be up there too, at the higher ranking. Can you tell me just a little bit about your involvement with the REEDS Act and why this is so significant, this presentation?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Allard, I've advocated for the REEDS Act and got it introduced in bill form several times between 2015 and when it finally passed the last time around, based upon the other states that have seen success with the REEDS Act.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. If it's okay, can we go back to K through 12 spending increase 2004 to 2022? What I took away from this is that over the last 18 years, Alaska has increased their spending less than the national average. So this amount that we've spent per student has gone up less than the national average. So I appreciate this slide and I thank you for it. And then in terms of just, and you know, I'm not an expert on poverty in Florida and Mississippi, but I just would think that there'd be probably more people using honey buckets and outhouses in Alaska than in Florida and Mississippi. And maybe some of the ways that they're measuring poverty might be different because Alaska is very different.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I can't speak to that. I'm just bringing the statistics that are available.
Please continue.
And
hold on a second. Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, I've asked this before, and I'm hoping that you've had some time to look into it, but how did Mississippi and Florida fund their versions of the Reeds Act?
Through the chair, I represent Himshute. I'm sure they went through a process of prioritizing what elements of their spending were the most important and prioritized those first.
Follow up?
Representative Himshute.
So after their laws were passed, was there funding allocated to implement those laws?
Through the chair, Representative Himshute, yeah, absolutely there was.
Thank you.
Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, one thing I've wondered if you've looked at is what they have invested into the Reeds Act in Florida and Mississippi, dollar-wise, and then also the rates of teacher retention, what has been the rates on that in the state.
Through the chair, Representative Story, I haven't looked into those, but I can look those up.
Please continue.
And at this point, I'll pass this off to Sarah for her portion of the presentation.
Ms. Montalbano, can you hear me?
Yes, am I audible?
You are audible, and we are on the overall education spending in Alaska slide.
Perfect, I thought so. Thank you all for having me today. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things, and I have made notes of all of your great questions, and I will work with Bob to get them answered. Looking at this slide, we see figures, and then these figures, it's important to note, are all sources of funding at the state, local, and federal levels. Per pupil spending in Alaska, nominal dollars in 2020 was $18,313, according to the Census Bureau. Estimates range up to about $21,000 if you are looking at averages across districts. We will see that in a chart in just a few slides from that source. But pretty much no matter how you slice it, Alaska in 2020 spent almost 50% more than the national average, which was $13,494. Looking at these figures are a little misleading, though, because we have such a wide variation in per pupil spending across districts, and I picked the highest and lowest here for demonstrative purposes. The Aleutian Region School District, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, just looking at their district search for the 2018-2019 school year, spent $104,000 per pupil. The Galena City School District only spent $7,302 in that same year. But looking at Alaska's more urban districts, the Anchorage School District spent $16,525 per pupil, and for interest, the Matthew Borough is about $16,000. So that is about where urban students are landing on this scale. In between 2002 and 2020, Alaska's total education expenditures rose 32% per pupil, and that is after inflation adjustment. Next slide, please, Bob. And so talking about cost of living, if we are there yet, this study I found is really interesting, and I encourage you to look at their methods more closely in that link that is sourced. The Education Law Center looks at state-by-state combined state and local revenues, and they adjust the regional cost of living variations. And what we see on average is that Alaska is funded about $2,000 more per pupil above the national average in the 2019-2020 school year. And so there's a few notes on methods there. I'll call your attention to the chart on the right, taken straight, screenshot out of their study. What's interesting to note is Alaska is one of the few states in their ranking that is getting A's and B's exclusively on their different categories. And Alaska received an A for the distribution of funding that goes towards high poverty districts. As we move from left to right on this chart, we see poverty increase, poverty rates increase from 0 to 50%. On the vertical axis, we see state and local per pupil revenues. And this red line is what the Education Law Center expects to see increases in funding as we increase the poverty rate. And we can see the plot of actual districts that many fall above this line, and the few relatively high poverty districts that are called out below the line are the Galena City School District and the Nana City School District, of both of which have large correspondence programs. Education expenditures for high poverty districts were 57% more in 2020 than low poverty districts. And another interesting piece from the study is that Alaska puts proportionately more of its state GDP into education than the national average. Alaska puts in about 4.42%. The national average is around 3.5. And over this time period from 2008 to 2020, they note that GDP declined 8%, but pre-kindergarten through 12th grade revenue increased 18%. Next slide, Bob. I'm going to take a moment for us to linger on this slide, because I think it is a really important one to look at. So this plot shows all of the Alaska schools, pretty much. There are some that fall outside of this axis. So as we move from left to right, we have per pupil expenditures from all sources. The lowest end is $5,000. It goes up to $40,000 per pupil. And we saw that Aleutian region, for example, some of these schools fall outside of this and aren't shown on the plot. The percentage of students proficient is on the vertical axis. It ranges from 10 to 90%. And that, I believe, is averaged across both the reading and math portions of the AK Star exam. And that average statewide is about 39% proficient. And I really encourage all of you to follow that link, play around with this graph, because it has a bunch of interactive measures. We can see on the right many of these legend entries. If you know the district you want to look at or search the school in particular, you can do that. You can also filter by the grades served in elementary schools or secondary schools. School type, I think, is visible on this graph. The plus signs are charter schools, and all of the circles are traditional public schools, but there's also measures for alternative schools and vocational schools and things like that, so you can filter down to those. The locale type is not shown on the static graph, but you can filter by the size of the cities, towns, remote areas, rural areas, classified by the National Center for Education Statistics. What we can see here is enrollment size. So the size of the circle is de-enrollment. Larger circles have higher enrollment. And then we can also see in the colors the percentage of students that are economically disadvantaged. And I would have to check what exact metrics they're using for that. But they assign green. Greener colors are lower poverty, red, orange are higher poverty. And so I've called out a few schools on this. The Skagway School, we saw from Bob's slides that the Skagway School District does the best on these state standardized tests, and they are relatively high spending compared to the rest of these schools. There's a cluster of five charter schools in this upper left-hand corner that are relatively low spending and high outcomes. And then the interesting large circle I've drawn, all of the schools falling within this better circles are correspondence schools. And you can see that some of these schools are falling below the average, but most of them are above the average and sometimes by large margins, 10 or 20% higher proficiency. The general trend that we see is not only that higher spending doesn't necessarily mean better outcomes, but that it largely looks to be the opposite, that we have a large cluster of relatively low spending, high performing schools, and as we move towards higher spending, that outcomes are falling. If there are no questions, let's proceed to the next slide.
I have a question on that slide, please. We have a couple questions, actually. Representative Hemshute, you can ask yours first.
Oh, thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, when we talk about educational outcomes, I'm curious what the source is for outcomes. Is this NAEP data? I'm sorry, through the chair, I may have forgotten that.
Still the higher spending through the, through the chair, we're still on the higher spending chart.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, apologies.
Okay. Let's see. My apologies. Through the chair, Representative Hemshue, Georgetown Edgenomics Lab is using our Alaska Star assessment. And so these, they look at the state tests for each of these states. I believe they have a chart for every state that is similar, but they are looking at the AK Star exam.
Follow up? Follow up?
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Montalbano. So if we're talking about, I need to clarify, did you say that the circle that you drew were around largely correspondence schools?
Yeah, this circle, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Hemshue, this large circle that I drew on the left side of the chart is entirely correspondence schools except for those three plus signs. Those are charter schools. You're welcome to look into the links and see which schools are which.
Thank you. And through the chair, you realize correspondence schools have a 15% or lower participation rate in statewide testing?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshue, that is correct.
Thank you.
Ms. Montalbano, I want to double check something. You said that the color scheme that you used here, red equaling lower income or closer to poverty, and green equaling above poverty. Is that what I understood the color scheme?
Representative, through the chair, this chart, I have not assigned these colors. This is the Georgetown Edgenomics Lab. We can see in the bottom right legend area, there's the percentage of economically disadvantaged students. It falls on a gradiated color scale. So the most green have the lowest poverty. That's, you know, the greenest is 0%. The reddest is, you know, 100%. And if you are interested, there are toggles where you can look at these poverty brackets. I believe it's from 0 to 25% or 25 to 50, whatever that ends up being.
So I think the takeaway that I take from this slide is that maybe the number one factor here for results is economic conditions for the families in these areas, meaning as you go up and to the left, you get into more non-economic disadvantaged, and you also get to better proficiency, even though that whole quadrant, if you will, of proficiency is still below the national average. But if I were to address anything here to change results, it would be focused on how do you make the families non-economic disadvantaged. Would that not be the takeaway from this slide? Or at least one takeaway from this slide?
Representative through the chair, you would be welcome to take that away. That is not necessarily what I am seeing. We can see that there are still a significant number of orange and yellow circles in the upper left quadrant, and there are still some very green circles that are in the lower right quadrant that are having high spending and poor outcomes. So this shows an overall trend, but it does not prove a rule.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it. And please continue with your – I'm sorry. We've got hands going up all over. So we'll go with Representative Story, then Representative Allard, and then Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, to the guest presenter, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. I'm on the cost of living chart,
And I think your third bullet about we're putting proportionally more of GDP into education than the national average, it seems to me this would be a metric that we wouldn't want to be using, because the price of oil really sets our GDP, and that can fluctuate based on what years you picked. For example, if we picked between year 26 to 21, and 21 was the high cost of oil input, I think it, let's see, it would be, the GDP would grow by 27%. And so here it says in the first line, by choosing those base years, those particular years, it's 4.42%. But if we just change the years and look at what the price of oil was, we would definitely get a different number. So I think my question is, this was the study done by the Education Law Center, and that's the years they chose to use?
Representative Story, through the chair, I believe that the Education Law Center's 4.42% is the point year of the 2019-2020 school year. I'd be happy to verify that. They did specifically mention the 2008 to 2020 time frame.
Follow up.
Yeah. Representative Story?
Yeah, my point would just be, I think I would caution us to be careful to use that number.
Representative Allard?
Thank you, and through the chair. So I think it's, I don't know which slide it is. It says higher spending doesn't necessarily mean better outcome slide. On there, I noticed Eagle Academy Charter School. Thank you for using them as an example. That's in my district, and my daughters actually went there. Did you guys take into consideration some of the things that these particular charter schools have? And I could give you an example. Eagle Academy Charter School has dress codes. They all wear uniforms. They have longer school days by an hour. And the academics is different than the brick-and-mortar public schools. And they also run on a lottery, so anybody, based if their number is called, can do that. Did any of this come into your analysis?
Representative Allard, through the chair, I appreciate those examples. It's really hard to disaggregate the specific things that charter schools are doing and try to assign causality for these high outcomes due to school uniforms or longer school days and things like that. The main benefit of a lot of charter schools is that they do things differently than public schools in certain situations, but we can't attribute any specific pieces to Eagle Academies. High performance on this chart.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Montalbano. So I'm curious about a comment that I guess it was Representative Himshute made about the 15% for the charter school testing. Should we assume then from this that the 15% that didn't take the tests were the lowest performing students, or should we just figure that that's a cross section and we shouldn't worry about it? I'm curious if that's statistically significant or if it's or not.
Yeah, Representative McCabe, through the chair. So this 15% participation rate on the AK STARS for correspondence school students. Correspondence school students tend to opt out at much higher rates than traditional public school students to this kind of testing. It could mean that we have an unrepresentative sample size, that we're seeing the best students that are taking this exam. What I find is perhaps equally likely is that we are getting a sampling of parents that don't mind their child taking this exam, and that it may not be linked to the best and the brightest of the correspondence school students. I'm not sure it's misrepresentative, but we do have a low sample size of the total correspondence school population.
So, follow up.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. So conversely, then, of course, it could be that there are the top 15% that just figure it's not worth their while to take this test and they opt out of it as well. So the results could even be statistically higher if we think of it. I mean, if we're separating them from the cross section, right?
Representative McCabe through the chair. I would have to probably defer to Deed and their statisticians on this issue. I don't personally see it as any more or less likely that we're getting the top 15% of students in the correspondence school programs or that we're getting the lowest 15% of students. I imagine it's probably a middle sampling of all these students.
Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge. I'll grab that one.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, Ms. Montalbano. A couple of things, questions. So I wanted to know on the left side of this graph that we're looking at for higher spending doesn't necessarily mean better outcomes. Is the proficiency percentage in math or reading?
Representative Ruffridge, through the chair, what I believe I read in this methodology, and I would be happy to follow up with you to make sure, is that they are doing an average of the two subjects. So, you know, if a school has, I can't do mental math right now, but it's taking the average of their overall across all grades proficiency, and that statewide average is 39%.
Okay, thank you. And just one other question, if I may.
Follow up.
So I think one of the takeaways I had from this, and maybe help correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but if the ones on the left and then the giant circle are correspondence schools, which we've already talked about some of the issues with the fact that, you know, 85% of them don't take the AK star, but one of the key components of that and something that's interesting to note is class size. So typically, a correspondence school is a class size of, well, if it was me being homeschooled, it was a class size of two. Sometimes my sister would show up and we'd kick her out, so it'd still be a class size of two. But I'm wondering if there is a correlation here between class. It would be interesting to note what class sizes have in regards to some of these circles, because I took away some of the same information as Representative Carpenter, that smaller, poorer schools, there's an economic association here. And it seems like all the circles in the big circle have a little higher economic portfolio and a class size that's more than likely very small. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, Representative Ruffridge, through the chair, I would definitely encourage you on your own time to toggle through the enrollment sizes, because that's not precisely class size, but that does give you a sense of how large these schools are. As far as class sizes, we can obviously see that we have larger enrollment, but I have not done any research on the class sizes of these schools, and I don't know if that information is readily available through the Edunomics Lab. So I will do some research on that and get back to you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have a question about this chart as well. I also see the same thing that Chair Carpenter sees, which is that the vast majority of the red is below the line and the green is above the line, which would imply that the major change we need to make is to get these schools out of poverty, the students out of poverty. I'll point out, I know you mentioned the charter schools being in the upper left-hand corner. We see lots of plus signs. I just was noticing that they're all green. All the plus signs that I see are green, which would imply that parents who make a lot of money send their kids to charter schools. This comes up in Anchorage, where I represent, all the time, because although anyone, it's a lottery system, as Representative Allard said, but you don't have a bus service. And so the parents who can put their kids in a charter school have to have the flexibility to drive their child to school and pick their kid up from school. Some parents don't have that flexibility, and they don't have that option. So I was wondering, is it correct that I'm seeing that all the charter schools are green?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I would call your attention. There are several orange plus signs in the lower left quadrant that are receiving lower outcomes while still having low spending. There are also some lighter green ones in there. Yeah. Not all plus signs are green on this chart.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, I I see what everybody's looking at about the green, but I'm wondering if we had a slide that you had like a flip, because I also see a lot of yellow and orange underneath the green. I think green is just a prominent color. I'm not trying to argue with anybody, but I do see quite a bit of the yellow, the orange in there too. So that was just an observation.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. So not to belabor this slide at all, but something that Representative Gray really struck me. Charter schools are doing pretty well. Looks like they're doing well because their parents can afford to send the kids there. That's awesome. Makes a great argument for vouchers. If we had school vouchers, if we had school choice, we could send all of our kids to charter schools and have a better outcome. Would that be a correct statement?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, school choice we'll come to later in the slide deck, assuming we have time to get there. And we talk about the outcomes, charter schools. We've done some studies at Alaska Policy Forum showing that even when you're comparing apples to apples, and I think this speaks to Representative Gray's observation about income levels, that even when we're looking at low-income students within charter schools, they're still performing better than their low-income counterparts in traditional public schools. And I personally think it would be a good thing to expand these opportunities and to have more charter schools, more seats open, because as Representative Allard mentioned, a lot of these seats are filled by lottery. And so that means there's losers in lotteries. There are students and families who are not picked to go to the charter schools.
So I'm going to have us move along here, but I want to make an observation that just to clarify, I am the first one that brought up what I thought I was seeing from the slide about economically disadvantaged, and I don't want it to be misconstrued to think that I would be agreeing that if we just spent more money on the schools where economically disadvantaged people live, that we would somehow see better results. That is not what I was trying to get at. I think this is a perfect example of why we have a joint meeting today and what it is that I'm trying to accomplish within this legislature right now, which is to stop squabbling over money and talk about how we get our economy growing. Because an economically disadvantaged school that's represented here in the lower right-hand quadrant is not a school that doesn't receive enough money. It's families that don't receive enough money. That is what economic disadvantage means to me. So if we were looking for policy decisions that are going to move the families from the lower right quadrant to the upper left quadrant, meaning move them from red to green, then we're talking about economic growth that impacts those families. There are many reasons why economically disadvantaged people might not be participating enough with their kids in school or taking enough ownership over the schooling part of that. Maybe it's because they're gone working all the time at a low wage job, whatever it is. But the point I'm getting at is, instead of squabbling over just what we have in control of ourselves, which is how much money to parse out over here or over here, we start talking about how we grow the economy so that everybody has an advantage. And this chart here shows that that's the problem that one of the problems that we have is economic disadvantage in the state of Alaska. Ms. Montalbano, please continue.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Bob, let's move us to the next slide, K-12 spending.
We're on there. Thank you.
Wonderful. So this chart I've put together from the NEA rankings and estimates reports. I used 2002 as the baseline because that is as far back as their rankings and estimates I was able to find these reports. And this looks at per pupil current expenditures by average daily attendance. Sticking with the same metric Bob was using in earlier slides. Current expenditures are all expenses, excluding things like capital outlay and interest on school debt that are highly variable from year to year. And the blue bar is what current expenditures actually were for that year, per student and average daily attendance. The gold bar shows what ADA would have been with adjustments upward for the annual Urban Alaska Consumer Price Index, non-seasonally adjusted, and that is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Those are annual rates. And I just use this for illustrative purposes. to show that indeed, from 2002 to 2008, we did see inflation outpacing what schools were actually getting, what current expenditures were per average daily attendance. And then due to formula changes in the 2008-2009 area, we jumped nearly $5,000. And then we our actual ADA current expenditures stayed well above what they would have been, keeping pace with 2002's inflation. Until 2021, we were 22% higher than the inflation rate, and those are mostly due to formula changes. This black line is superimposed to the National Assessment of Educational Progress on the secondary access for fourth graders in reading. And it shows that on our first exam in 2003, we were scoring about 212 on the average score. And to 2019, and then continuing into 2022, which is not shown, we're at 204. And so what education researchers tend to use as just a shorthand is that 10 points is approximately equal to a year of educational attainment. And while our spending was rising through this, we lost about 8 points. So that's most of a year's attainment. I'm ready for the next slide.
I'll get you on the list.
Thank you.
Please continue, Ms. Montalbano.
Thank you. Over this time period, we see administration growth rather than teachers. And of course, administration is important for school leadership. Other staff perform worthwhile and important function for schools, for the modern school. Investing directly in the high quality teachers that are in the classroom is what matters most for student performance. And in 2000, teachers were one-to-one with other staff looking at just everybody who isn't teaching in the classroom. There was one teacher for every member of other staff. In 2021, there were four teachers for every five staff members, and that is actually at its lowest over that time period. Looking specifically at district administrators, so we're not looking at school principals or school administrative staff, district administrators grew 17.7% between 2008 and 2019. And I mentioned 2008 was when these funding formula changes started. Over that time period, the number of teachers declined almost 6% during that. And the conventional explanation, which I do not have a problem with, is that compliance costs, especially at the federal level, have increased. And for that reason, Alaska is not unique in its administration growth. Staff per student doubled in the 30 years between 1970 and 1999. Next slide. And now we turn to the meat and potatoes of the education funding formula. I am sure the education committee members have heard this a million times, but I will give the quick rundown. The base student allocation is the amount given to each student before adjustments to average daily membership. Average daily membership is this enrollment average that is counted through 20 days in October of each year. Average daily membership is adjusted for factors including school size, district cost, special needs, career and technical education, intensive needs, and correspondence school students. And so our basic formula ends up being the BSA times adjusted average daily membership equals basic need. And basic need is met first with contributions from for those school districts that are in organized boroughs or municipalities. There are required local contributions and deductible federal impact aid, and the rest is paid for by the state. And the Citizens Guide points out that 63% of school district budgeted revenue is from the state. That is unusually high compared to the rest of the United States. The rest of the United States is around 47% contributed by state. Next slide, please. Oh, getting out of breath. All right. So the BSA, I really want to emphasize is not the whole picture of education funding. That is what I've taken away from this whole endeavor. And the Citizens Guide points this out pretty explicitly, that even with no change in the BSA since 2008 that they're discussing, changes in the adjustment factors would have increased K-12 funding by 34%. So we've just done some back-of-the-napkin calculations here. Inflation since 2008 was 39%. The BSA actually rose 10% since 2008. And so presumably those increases in the actual BSA with adjustment factors on top would meet or exceed inflation. I would be interested in some more in-depth calculations on the subject. But, of course, on top of the formula, we have one-time grants from the legislature, federal grants, the most recent being this COVID relief money through the CARES Act and the American Rescue Plan. People transportation funds are allocated from the state. Districts can also make voluntary local contributions up to a certain point. The state contributes to the teacher retirement system and the public employees retirement system. And then there's also school debt reimbursement and the Regional Education Attendance Area Fund. Next slide. So we talk here about Alaska's choice options, and under the current funding formula, they are not treated equally. This is a statistic you will hear throughout the presentation. Students in the correspondence school program are 16.5% of all students, but account for less than 5.3% of total funding. And that is because these correspondence school students are subtracted out from average daily membership at the beginning and are multiplied by 0.9, regardless of their actual special needs or any other weights that would apply to them if they were in a traditional public school. At the risk of stating the obvious, correspondence school students are not 90% of a student. They still have similar educational needs compared to traditional public school students. And then I would note that the allotment amount that families actually receive is a lot less than this 90% that is given from the BSA. A lot of these larger correspondence school programs depends on the school and the district, but families get around $2,500, and that's less than half of the BSA. And I mentioned in brief that correspondence students with identified intensive needs and disabilities are not given additional funding to meet those. Turning to charter schools, Alaska's charter schools are given an amount that is proportionate to their enrollment, but we see that up to 4% of those costs are retained by the school district for administration. Capital and facilities are not funded fairly either. One good thing is that charter schools do have the right of first refusal to purchase and use buildings that are still deemed safe that are being retired from school districts. But the construction, leasing, and maintenance grant programs are not currently being funded, and there's that source. Next slide, if we're ready.
So it looks like we're going to get into the charter school laws right now. Before we do that, I think we have a couple of questions on the previous slides that we're going to go to. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, I wanted to go back to the administration slide. I'm not sure. Oh, here it is. I wrote 23 on my page. It has been growing. And my question about that is, what are the definitions that you're using for administration? Because I know with DEED, they have said our district administration is 2% in the state of Alaska, and they base that on a chart of accounts that DEED requires the districts to report to. And this is... underneath that chart, this is who they consider district administration. So we see that it's 2%. So what are they including in administration?
Representative Story, through the chair, I'm using national statistics from the National Center for Education Statistics. These specific tables are linked there, and you would be able to find the definitions of the people that are counted as officials and administrators, as well as administrative support staff.
Representative Story, if you don't mind me asking a question, where is the information that the administration is 2% of the cost here in the state of Alaska? Where's the data you're using?
Sure. It was presented to the House Education Committee, so I can get that to you. They have a pie chart, and they've broken out. And then they have 3% is school administration, which is like the principals.
Okay.
So I can certainly get that to the committee.
We can probably look it up as well. I just wanted to know where you were getting that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's see. We've got Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm on the slide, the BSA isn't the whole picture. And there's a quote in here from the Citizens Guide to K-12 funding that even with no change in the BSA, the adjustment factors would have increased K-12 funding by 34%. So I've read the Citizens Guide to K-12 funding. Don't remember that being in there. And then I just got done looking through it again, and I don't see that quote in there again. And I'm wondering if this was from an older version of the Citizens Guide. I think I have the one from 2021 or something like that. Could you help me with where that quote is from?
This is on, so I've pulled up the source again. This is the Ledge Finance updated February 2023 version, and it is on the bottom of page 6.
Representative Himshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm on the slide, Alaska State Education Funding Formula. At the bottom of that slide, the final bullet point says 63% of school district budgeted revenue is from the state. And then you gave a different figure for other states. Can you clarify, when we talk about state spending, other states contribute to their schools through counties, which we don't have in Alaska. So can you clarify the total state spending on schools in other states?
Representative, through the chair, I would have to check. Of course, Alaska is unique, especially in its situation that 19 school districts are not in an organized borough or municipality, so they don't have these local contributions. Other states are organized by county.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess could we go back to the statement about changes in adjustment factors? Maybe. Anyway, the statement roughly was that changes in the adjustment factors would have increased spending by 34% or something like that. I forget the numbers.
BSA
but
isn't the whole picture.
Sorry. Yeah, BSA isn't the whole picture. But I was wondering if there were, I think that would have taken a specific statutory change to change, for instance, the special needs factor increases it by 20%, give or take. Increases the base student allocation by 20% per district. But I don't recall that that was changed since, no changes, since fiscal year 08.
Through the chair, if I can, I think fiscal year 08, the intensive needs factor was 5, if I'm not mistaken, and it's now 13.
That's correct. That's part of the changes.
Intensive needs. It's a little hard to figure out because the intensive need is per student, and special needs and career and technical education is just applied. If you have one, the whole school gets the increase. So it'd be interesting to know a little bit more about that. Something to check into.
Representative Prax, through the chair, we will be discussing the increase in intensive needs identification. that occurred after these school funding formula changes. So you'll be able to see the changes to adjusted average daily membership.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. So, Ms. Montalbano, I understand that we don't have counties. We do, however, have boroughs. I do have a borough tax that's contributed to my school district. I also think that the unorganized borough, which you said had, I can't remember how many school districts in the unorganized borough, but don't they get funding from the federal government that we don't get in the organized borough, because we contribute through our taxes to a school, but the unorganized borough doesn't. And I thought that they got some extra funding from the federal government. So not, I guess my point is the county versus borough argument is one I hear relentlessly, and I don't think it really makes a big difference. Maybe you could just confirm
that. Representative McCabe, I apologize. Continue.
Go ahead, Ms. Montalbano.
Okay.
Chair Carpenter.
Representative McCabe through the chair. I don't know on net if districts in unorganized areas are receiving more, but I do believe that they get more deductible federal impact aid, mostly because this is meant to offset the loss of property tax revenue for federal lands in these areas.
A follow-up, Representative McCabe.
So thank you. I expect that Representative Story is getting ready to correct me, but the federal impact aid, as I understand it, I've been talking for years about, hey, maybe we should reorganize, maybe we should organize the unorganized borough, and the argument against doing that has always been that it's going to cost the state money, more money to organize them, because we will lose the federal impact aid. And, you know, I've never looked into it that much, but to me, it sort of makes sense. There's a reason we haven't organized the unorganized borough, and I think it's because we get federal money for the schools. So the whole county versus borough argument, I'm just not sure makes sense.
Representative McCabe, I do not know enough to comment on that, on the fiscal changes there.
Thank you, Ms. Montalbano. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. I believe it's $77 million in impact aid that that we get, but we could check on the number. But I also wanted to just add, for correspondence students, the allotment is 90% of the BSA allotment, but I think that's because the brick-and-mortar schools have correspondence students have access to the school activities and classes, and also special education services. The charter schools, at least in our district and our correspondence school, the schools, the local school district needs to service special ed, and they share services.
Thank you, Representative Ruffridge, and then Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. I'm still on the BSAs of the whole picture slide. And I think you mentioned it actually in your answer to Representative Prox. So the adjustment factors that increased since 2008, essentially that's just one factor that I'm aware of, and that was the intensive need factors. Is that accurate? And I think it was like a gradual increase over time.
Representative, through the chair, what I believe are the changes, and I can confirm these things as well, that there was some gradual upping of the intensive needs factor. I think it went from 5 times in 2008 to 8 or 9, and then went up to 13 in the next few years. Those are rough numbers. The other change that I noted is that there was the reinstatement of the hold harmless provision, which we will discuss. Basically insulates school districts for changes in membership after adjusting for school size. I think right now it's 5%. In the early days of this education funding formula back before 2000, it was 10%. And so we reinstated that hold harmless with a lower threshold for receiving it.
Representative Prox?
We've moved away from it. Let's just move on.
Okay. So we've got about 20 minutes left in the meeting, and I would like to get through the slides. If you would please hold your questions, write them down, and we can address them at the end, or we'll address them afterwards. Ms. Montalbano, we are on Alaska Charter Schools Laws slide.
Wonderful. That is where I thought we were. Please, if you have any questions, feel free to write them down and ping them to me. I'll happily do this research and answer your questions. Returning to charter schools, Alaska's charter school laws have been ranked as the third most restrictive nationwide, in part because of these equitable funding issues for administrative costs and facilities and transportation. But Alaska also has these other factors that are not great about it. We lack multiple authorizers. And so the local school district board is pretty much the only option for charter schools to get authorized. Other states will do statewide charter authorizing boards, or local universities are able to authorize charter schools. Next slide. We turn to the meat and potatoes of recommendations for improvements to the school funding formula. Next slide. Here is our short list of ideas to improve the formula. Bob will talk first about these first two bullet points. Our incentives for inefficient facilities. We'll discuss the hold harmless provision that I just mentioned. And then we will return to me to talk about how we can incentivize improvement and outcomes. The identification of intensive needs students that we were just discussing, average daily membership, and then some notes on correspondent school students. Bob, I will let you take these slides.
On the bond debt reimbursement, that there's a loophole in the, basically the code that allows and incentivizes large districts to maintain inefficient facilities, small inefficient facilities running. That if we were to limit that bond debt reimbursement to, especially I'll cite the example specific, the Anchorage School District has built out capacity for about 53,000 students, and their projections and their capital improvement plans show that there'll be about 37,000 students or less if charter schools don't grow by 2027, and yet they keep small facilities open because of the loophole and the funding formula that gives them more money for keeping small schools open that was intended to benefit small rural areas. And there's certainly the bond debt reimbursement should be continued for rapidly growing places, but large school districts that have lots of excess capacity, we need to incentivize them to right size their facilities. Recommendation, the hold harmless provision. The hold harmless provision, we saw some impacts of that, of the double dipping that went on during COVID as schools lost students, but also we ended up spending, we're essentially incentivizing schools to not work hard to keep parents in their programs, that if parents leave, then we're essentially paying them for not educating a kid. And the double dipping that I mentioned specifically, I'll speed through the slides and we can take questions later. And Sarah, we're on the recommendations, incentivize outcomes and formula.
Perfect, thank you, Bob. Tennessee has a really interesting school funding formula now. They recently overhauled it. And what I will call attention to in it is that districts will receive per student bonuses based not only on the level of scores on some of these statewide English language arts assessments, but they will also be scored on growth. So from third grade to fourth grade, ELA growth, math scores as well. For the high school bound, ACT scores are considered, and if students take it more than once, they can get bonuses for significant improvements from previous tests. High schoolers that are not college-bound, schools are rewarded for those students who are graduating with industry credentials, which I think is important. Florida also does a good job. We discussed in Bob's slides the incentives for graduates to pass an AP exam with three or higher. There is a base funding bonus in Florida for districts, and there's also a direct-to-teacher bonus that varies depending on the economic advantage and disadvantage of that school district. And we saw that Florida is still among the lowest funding per student. And so I would say the message from this slide is that we should be rewarding the schools that are getting results and incentivizing the behaviors we want to see. Next slide. We mentioned intensive needs weighting during this Q&A. In fiscal year 2008, there was 1,877 intensive needs students, which added a little more than 9,000 to adjusted average daily membership. In fiscal year 2023, there were almost 3,300 intensive needs students, and that really jumps our adjusted average daily membership up to almost 42,000 extra students. And this 13 times across the board is not necessarily representative of the actual costs, the typical costs of these students, because Alaska lumps together students with disabilities and English language learners and gifted and talented. So one of the things I'll note again about Tennessee's new funding formula is they have a schedule of some common intensive needs and provide funding based on the typical costs of those things. Next slide. Bob, I can talk about these correspondence school students. These correspondence students also should get weights for this across-the-board special education, as well as CTE, because hundreds of these CSAP students have special needs or are participating in CTE. And then the correspondent students with intensive needs should receive weights not only to the district spending that districts get, but to the allotment. And we use the example here of 10. That just is to make an easy calculation. That's more than enough for a lot of parents to choose between providers for their child's needs, but the state would still realize cost savings, so that number can change. Florida Family Empowerment Scholarship Program that Bob mentioned earlier does this with 90% of state special ed funding. Next slide. Our school size multiplier is rather complicated. The way it's working now is the small schools under 20 students receive a multiplier of 39.6 flat for all of those students. Schools with more than 750 students are penalized with a multiplier of 0.84 for every student above 750, is my understanding. Schools above 250 students, that is where you see the tipping point where you see the district receives less in average daily membership per additional student than the actual number of students. It's slightly under 3% less. The intention of this is to help rural school districts with their higher per student costs, and I have no doubt that it does that. But large school districts also have incentives to exploit this and keep inefficient facilities open. And so we use National Center for Education Statistics data, the sources below, that the median school size in Alaska is 177 students, and under statute, that's a weight of 8% higher. And this lowest tier applies to 63 of Alaska's 513 schools. There's only 26 schools that are being downweighted for over 750. So it's not immediately clear to us why all of these intricate gradations are put into place, and it seems to create bad incentives. So there's a couple ways we could handle this. The first is that we just have a simple whole number weight for schools below a certain number of students, I use here 50, and eliminate these higher tiers. The other alternative is that districts above a certain number of students just should not be eligible for the school size multiplier, and we reduce this perverse incentive. Next slide, please. Bob, if you'd like, this is kind of your thing.
Sure. I'll address this. The average daily membership in Alaska has a 29% rate of chronic absenteeism, highest in the U.S. by definition. Students who miss more than 15 days of school or three school weeks are considered chronically absent. Because of the way we calculate our formula compared to California, California only has a 12% rate of chronic absenteeism. And a quick comparison to Los Angeles, the Kenai, Los Angeles has about a as a 13% rate compared to Kenai. If there was some change in the calculation, the ADM that would allow for that, that the data shows that states that account for that budget based upon actual daily attendance have much lower rates of chronic absenteeism. And we're onto the school choice nationwide sign, and Sarah will get about 6 minutes.
Wonderful. I will speed through these. Alaska has traditional neighborhood public schools, and for a lot of students, that is pretty much the only option. We also have our public homeschooling and correspondence schools, independent homeschooling, private schools, public charter schools, technical education, and magnet schools. Other states have forms of private school choice, and I won't read off the list of the interesting things other states are doing, but it's worth noting that 32 states have programs that allow funding to follow the student in 2023. Next slide. This is the study I referenced earlier that Alaska Policy Forum has done. We looked at some public records requests for the 2017 through 2019 PEAKS assessments, all before the pandemic. And what we found is that apples to apples, regardless of ethnicity, gender, or special subgroup, charter school students are performing better than students in traditional public schools. And it's worth noting here as well that Alaska scored the highest for value-added learning gains on these ecosystem rankings. Next slide. States appear to benefit academically from choice as well. A very recent study came out using this Education Freedom Index, and it finds a positive and significant association between education freedom and outcomes. And Alaska ranked 42nd in 2000, dropped to 49th in 2019. And this quote, I hope, will hit you as hard as it hits me. Both the geography and the public policies of Alaska leave its families nearly void of educational options beyond their assigned public school. Next slide. This was presented to House Education on the first of this month. I will note here briefly that the vast majority of these studies that are included find positive effects of some sort on participants in school choice. Their test scores, they've improved academically. Parents are overwhelmingly show positive effects on parental satisfaction. And then fiscal effects, there are generally positive effects as well. And you can see the list of studies in that source if you are curious. And then finally, next slide, I'm sorry. We look at states benefiting fiscally from choice. I will breeze past the Arizona example. But EdChoice estimates per student savings between $3,300 and $7,500 generated through fiscal year 2018. And for each dollar spent on these private choice programs like ESAs, there are fiscal savings of between $1.80 and $2.85. Bob, I turn it to you to discuss CSAP.
Really quickly, I'll go through the Alaska's most popular choice program, the Correspondence Allotment Program. We have about 21,000 students statewide that receive 90% of the base student allocation. Again, as we talked before, 16% of the students and 5.3% of the spending. Just running through the overall expenditures, when we take these CSAP students and set them aside compared to other students on $2.1 billion and 126,000 kids, the non-correspondent students actually drives their per student funds available up to nearly $19,000 for the 105,000 students are less. And when we include that adjusted in 2022 dollars, the non-correspondent students are receiving about $4,000 per student more than they did in fiscal year 2005 from the Ledge finance briefing. A couple of hypothetical situations that we just wanted to run through is hypothetically, if we restricted correspondence courses, if we encouraged correspondence courses, and the fiscal effects if we added an intensive needs option. If we were somehow to write a code that didn't allow the correspondence courses and force them all back into brick-and-mortar schools, it would generate about $162 million in additional funding formula costs. And because of the kids coming back with the same amount of money would actually drive the per student availability funds down to $257. If we were to encourage correspondence scenario in the case that we recommended a 2.15 for both special needs and correspondence and CTE instead of the 0.9, it would raise the CSAP allotment to $7,200. In this case, if the enrollment increased the pre-pandemic levels to 21.8%, it would get about an $87 million savings in funding formula, and because of the increased amount of $52 million increase in correspondence, with a net total of $35 million savings and an increase in per student of $387 for non-correspondence programs. And attendance, the model after the Family Empowerment Program, if we had a 10 times the BSA instead of 13 times the BSA, if 20% of parents with intensive needs children chose a CSAP provider, it would be about a $14 million savings and funding formula, and also incentivize districts to be attentive to students and parents in that category. Our quick takeaways is the top line, incentives matter. Outcomes are on the rise, but we're far from acceptable. Improvements within our reach with the examples that we cited, that more money doesn't necessarily equate to better results unless it's focused in the cases that we saw for Tennessee and Florida. We poorly allocate resources. We spend a lot of money on buildings and bureaucracies that would be better served in probably classroom operations. Funding formula flaws, again, divert resources from teachers and students. And our charter schools would be even better if we had fewer restrictions. Bottom line, healthy competition improves outcomes and fiscal efficiency. 30 seconds to spare.
Okay, what's your evening, folks? Questions at this point? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter, and through the chair, thank you for the presentation this evening. And I had asked a question earlier on the slide with all the bubbles where we spent a lot of time about the issue of class sizes. We spent a lot of time talking about Florida this evening as well, and I wondered if it sounds like you spent a lot of time looking into Florida. So in the early 2000s, it's my understanding that Florida actually passed a constitutional amendment by the vote of the people for a class size number, and then funded it over the course of the next 20 years with over $50 billion in order to reduce class sizes in Florida. And I was intrigued as to why class sizes didn't make it into a presentation this evening. Is that something you speak about, I guess, briefly?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, we're certainly willing to come back and discuss that subject. It wasn't on the agenda today, but I would point out that despite that spending increase in reducing class sizes, Florida has managed to keep their budget in a pretty tight range compared to us.
Representative Hemshoot.
I have three questions. Is that okay?
Make them quick.
I'll try. Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Through the chair, Mr. Griffin, you've been going strong all day, so well done. Thank you for sticking with us. You know I'm interested in Finland. They, in the 80s, went through a really difficult economic time, and they doubled down on public education, and they've been a top performer since then. They do not have school choice. Can you speak to that?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, is the previous presentation that we gave on the 1st of March, I think it was, pointed out, though Finland in itself does not have school choice, in the top 10 highest performing PISA test score districts, there are many school choice countries in there and a large number throughout Western Europe. The United States is not unusual at all as far as OECD countries and offering school choice opportunities.
Second question.
Thank you. Through the chair. Can you tell us more about your organization? At the beginning, we didn't really fully get who you are and who your organization is and how you're funded and tell us more, please.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, the Alaska Policy Forum is a nonpartisan think tank, part of the SPN network of about 70 think tanks across all 50 states. I'm not familiar with their the funding, I'm personally a volunteer.
Follow up?
Representative Himshu, if I may add, we don't accept any sources of government funding. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Anchorage.
Thank you. Through the chair, what is SPN?
The State Policy Network.
Okay, thank you.
Question number three, Representative Himshu.
Okay, through the chair. I'm just going to ask this. I probably can't be very diplomatic here, but what is it you've told us tonight, or what are you offering that solves a problem that isn't solved by buttressing our public schools?
Through the chair, Representative Himshu, I'm just, I think, pointing to some obvious statistics that we do poorly on things that we want to do better on, and examples of other places that do quite well with fewer resources. That if back to the takeaways, incentives matter, and healthy competition improves fiscal efficiency and outcomes, I think is a strong correlation that we can draw from the items we've mentioned.
Thank you.
Representative Ballard.
Are we allowed to make comments yet? Are we holding back on that? Just in response to Representative Himshu.
I don't think I can hold you back from making a comment.
Through the chair.
Representative Ballard.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair. I have to say that as someone who has kids in the school district, I really appreciate your presentation. I've learned a lot from your presentation. I learned that even though we may be funding quite a bit in our state, that Mississippi and Florida are shown to be successful, especially with them implementing their version of the READS Act. And there's a lot of takeaways I have from this, the numbers that if they can do it, we can do it too. And I appreciate that. And there's a lot of growth. There's a lot of things we need to do. And what I've also figured out is that economic growth is directly tied to our education system, which then would go into education choice. So I appreciate it. And I know a lot of people are like, well, Mississippi, Florida, but we're comparing to Finland all the time and or other countries in the committee meeting. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you for that statement, Representative Allard. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I want to talk about slide 22 again. I'm going to reference slide 12, but I'd like us to look at slide 22.
What is the heading on the top of that slide, Representative?
Oh, K through 12, spending outpaces inflation since 2002. Yes, that one. Mm-hmm. So, as I mentioned earlier, I liked slide 12 because that's the one that showed that from 2004 to 2022, our increase in spending was less than the national average. So when we look at that line, seeing that our average NAEP score, I guess they have to say, is 212 in 2003-ish, 2004-ish. And I'll just say the average for the nation at that time was 2017. So we were less than the national average then. And then we go down, and it looks like we're at 204 right now. So we've come down a long ways. I'll say that my Google search showed that the nation has kind of remained at 217. So what I'm hearing, and this is kind of tying into Representative Ruffridge's, like, what's the overall message of the slide deck? I feel like the overall message is that people want to spend more money on education in Alaska, but education's not doing well in Alaska, and other states have done well with a lot less. And so rather than, you know, spending more money, let's do what Florida did. And that way we don't have to spend any more money. But what I see here is I know we haven't kept up with the national average, and our test scores have fallen down. And I think that if we look at any other industry or place, like when outcomes are doing badly, we don't cut the money from them. We don't take the money away. If a crime goes up in a city, we don't tell the police department that we're going to give you less money until crime goes down. And I kind of feel like that's kind of what the message is. Maybe I'm missing it. But our test scores are going down. To me, that means we need to really throw something at this to improve our outcomes. And my feeling is that what we're being told is that we could just try a charter school or try some other options from some other states. But I just think that getting more teachers, attracting more teachers, getting more better education happening in the classroom will require money, and that's what we need.
So if I might help focus the question.
Was that a question?
Well, I think, are you saying that we don't need more money to raise that 204 up?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I think we probably allocate our resources through K-12 education, and by retargeting them to incentivizing better outcomes, I think we could achieve better results without a lot of increase in spending.
Can you, just on that subject, can you go to the last slide, your recommendations for me, please? Your takeaways, thank you. So I don't see on any of those bullets where the takeaway from our meeting is that we should reduce spending on education.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I've never endorsed or advocated for reducing spending in K-12 education.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate that. Can I do one quick follow-up?
Representative Gray.
Thank you. I just was going to follow up. I forget the woman who's online.
Ms. Montalbano.
I know that you mentioned that the Alaska Policy Forum is a nonpartisan entity, and I have the list of the associated networks with the Goldwater Institute, with Americans for Prosperity, the American Conservative Union Foundation, Americans for Tax Reform, the Cato Institute, the Charles Koch Institute. Those, to my mind, don't ring as nonpartisan. And I mean, it's just something that I noticed that I had, that I feel like. So the question is, what's the point? The point is that she said it's nonpartisan, and I believe it is partisan. If you believe it's nonpartisan, explain it to me. Thank you. Thank you.
Hold on a second. The chair's going to make a comment about this. So plenty of organizations out there that fit into the category that the IRS has defined as partisan or nonpartisan. We all are going to have an opinion on whether their activities fit into our political beliefs or not, and we're likely to draw conclusions as to whether they're partisan or nonpartisan, but they fit the category of the IRS. And I don't think that it's fair to criticize the Alaska Policy Forum when they say they're nonpartisan. They are meeting the requirements of the IRS to maintain their status as a nonpartisan organization. They are certainly not a political party. They are not advocating in this briefing for a particular political party or a solution that a political party is advocating for right now, especially in the state of Alaska. So I fail to see how the partisanship or nonpartisanship status of this organization has anything to do with the briefing that was given today.
I apologize, Chair. That was a good explanation of what nonpartisan is, and I learned something, and I apologize for the comment.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Well, my list has got Representative McCabe on it.
Thank you. So I'm speaking to slide 12, and you don't have to go there, but increase in spending is not total spending. It's simply how much we increase. The title of the chart is increased spending, not total spending. So I think that's the difference, maybe. It might surprise you to know that the average Alaska class size in 2017 and 2018 was 21.6. The Florida law says for class from fourth grade through eighth grade is 22, and from ninth through 12th is 25. So I'm not sure that the class size is relevant, although I would welcome a slide or a discussion on the class size versus outcomes from the class. We hear the same argument all the time. You know, the class size needs to be reduced, for a better outcome. I wonder if it does. And I want to make a statement on the BSA and throwing money at it. Increasing the BSA does not give necessarily money to the teachers and the classroom. That's what I took away from this whole thing. We could increase the BSA $1,250, and a fraction of that would go to educating our kids because of the contracts that are signed and negotiated between administrators. In fact, I think we proved here that the majority of it would go to the districts themselves. So we have got to find a better way, in my opinion, to increase the outcome for our students by increasing the teacher pay. Nobody at this table is saying we need to decrease teacher pay, decrease money to the students, decrease money to the classroom. What we are saying is we need to find a better way to get money away from the superfluous stuff and get back to the 2016 law that we repealed that said 70% of the money needs to go to the teachers in the classrooms and the students, frankly. So that's my rant.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Representative Story, and then Representative Grow.
Yes, thank you. May I make a comment, Chair?
Representative Story.
Thank you. I'm concerned about just understanding of intensive needs funding, and I think it'd be important to have Deed talk to us about the Deed's funding, because that there is an audit that's done for each child that's classified as intensive. There are very complex care that they've needed and complex disabilities, and they have to meet once a district categorizes someone as special needs, Deed audits that to make sure that they are special needs and they meet all of those, I think it's like 15 categories. And so there are, and they're a level 3 intensive, and we have level 1 special education, level 2, and level 3. And then level 3 intensive is really a small number of the total special education students. So I just think it'd be really important to have Deed talk about that a little bit more, because I don't think they're incentivizing to have special ed students. There's a protection against that that Deed has to see. That is, and of course, districts with 13 times, you're hiring another staff person to take care of that child. They need one-to-one. It's different from like a para who might be able to help three. It's just, anyway, I think from comments tonight, it would be really helpful to make sure I'm getting this right, and for the committee to know, because I think it's critical.
I'm in agreement with you, Representative Story. It would be good to see the information, especially if we're auditing how things are actually being done. I appreciate that. Representative Groh.
Thank you, Chair Kribner. It sounds very much like Representative McCabe wants to increase compensation for teachers, and I just want to let him know that I can introduce him to some people who can talk to him about defined benefits for teachers. I'm really glad to hear this shift tonight, and I'm going to go away encouraged. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Groh. Let me see. Check in the room for final comments or questions. Representative Prox.
A graph we didn't see, and I forget where it is, but there's a strong indication that parents are voting with their feet. Certainly in the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, there has been a long-term decline of, I think, the total of now almost 20% over the years, and a corresponding increase in correspondence programs outside of the district. And there's other factors, but the school allowing parents to choose is a very important part of this, as indicated by parents choosing. I think we need to consider that.
Thank you, Representative Prox. I myself have had multiple conversations along that very same line with multiple administrators, and I have not yet received an answer that my district, in my school district within my district, understands why parents are choosing to leave. And I think that is a very key factor in decisions that we need, helping us understand what we need to do at the state level to impact this. Maybe the state needs to do nothing. Maybe we need to understand first why parents are leaving. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you. And I do appreciate that a lot of parents want choices. And I know in the Juneau School District, we have the Clinic of Culture Language Literacy, and we have Montessori, and we have our charter school, and we have a Homebridge school, and they're all within our neighborhood schools. We're all a big part. But I think the statistic, according to Deed, is 83% of our kids are in brick and mortar, and 17% are in correspondence. And so we still have the vast majority of kids who are in their neighborhood schools, and so we need to be taking care of all of our kids. And I just wanted to put that in there for context.
Appreciate that. Any other comments? Representative Prox and then Representative McCabe.
Something else that needs to be investigated a little more. Maybe the policy forum would be interested in that. The they call it the Molly Hooch settlement, drives a lot of spending decisions within Alaska's school system. So some of these options might not be available to us, but somebody needs to take a look at that.
Thank you, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I've heard a couple of things tonight about deed statistics, and I will tell you that some of the deed statistics, I had a discussion with the head of the school administrators, and she said that 74% of the money that is spent goes to instruction. So I looked up what instruction was. Instruction includes all the buildings in Kodiak and Mount Edgecombe. It includes all the administrative costs from the administrators down to the principals. All of that is lumped in instruction. So I sent a request to have all of that taken out and find out exactly how much money is spent in the schools, and I have yet to have a reply. The report cards that are online are wildly false. The Matsu School Borough or the school district came to us and showed the Matsu delegation how wildly false the report cards are on that deed site, and we requested that they be taken down and fixed, and they are still on there. So I trust almost zero of the statistics that are on the deed site. So maybe we need to fix that first so we can understand exactly what we're talking about.
Thank you. Any other comments from our presenters today, Mr. Griffin or Ms. Montalbano?
Just really quickly, one last comment is that it is quite interesting that we have 17% of our parents in correspondence programs. The easiest thing to do as a parent is to stick your kid out of the bus stop and 6.5 hours later come back and pick them up. And the fact that we have a large percentage of parents that are doing the hard thing, I think, sends a strong message.
Ms. Montalbano, you have the last word this evening, if you would like.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. What I will say about that statistic is that I believe this is an Ed Choice study. It finds that what parents desire is not always what they are able to do. And when there are more choice options, parents are able to utilize those options better. And then their actual behavior aligns more with their preferences. And I'd be happy to find that reference again. I would say the biggest takeaway from this presentation to me is that incentives matter, and these portions of the school funding formula we've looked at tonight, we see states that have aligned their school funding formula to reward and incentivize what they want to see. And it doesn't mean that we need to spend less overall. It just means that we need to have more targeted funding to improve these outcomes, because I really do think it's a travesty that so many of Alaska students are not reading proficiently at a basic level and aren't able to do basic math. So that's why we're here. We want 100% of students to reach 100% of their potential.
Can I say one last thing?
Nope, she had the last word. Thank you for being here, Ms. Montalbano. Mr. Griffin, thank you. And as of 8:21 p.m., we are adjourned.